Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 25th. I'm Ray Graff. It is our gardening show for the month of August today. And joining us, our panel of experts. We're joined today by arborist Fred Breglia, also by arborist Fred Breglia of the Landis Arboretum. And arborist Fred Breglia will be here from the Landis Arboretum. Yes, it's all about Fred today and your calls on this gardening show. 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Did I mention that Fred Breglia is on the show today? Well, he is. It's amazing. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. We'll start the gardening show after the news, and then it'll be time for Fred Breglia. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for the gardening show today, a familiar voice, Fred Breglia, is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. He is an expert. You know him well from these programs. We welcome your calls, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or tweet us at @WAMCVoxPop. Or email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551 on this gardening show, usually a panel of two or three. Fred Breglia, it's just you today.
I know that, but you know what? We got it covered, I think, Ray. So it's great to be here again.
You like to speak, so it should be okay.
I enjoy public speaking.
I guess so. I was on vacation in late July, and you did one of these, and also a solo shot.
This is two this year, I believe.
Okay. Well, I got this card here, and it's these beautiful paintings, and on the back it says, Fred Breglia, When Trees Talk, Global Warming. Okay, I know you're a good guitar player, but a painter as well?
I also do painting. I haven't done a real lot in, since I had two children. But
yeah, that'll stop a lot of things.
That slowed it down a little bit. But I've been, the last year or so, really putting out some new paintings and a little bit different perspective than what I had been doing in the past. And they actually were on display all month at the Guildhall Library. And we do have a artist reception coming up on August 27th at 1 p.m., thinking probably about an hour's worth of time, but I'll be there, answer any questions, give a little insight as to what some of these paintings mean. There's some interesting ones there, and certainly you'll see resemblances to Landis Arboretum, or I should say at least some of the influences of my art, which, you know, certainly work
so
in the Arboretum.
Were you trained, or you learn all this yourself?
You know, real short story here. In high school, I thought I'd actually go to school for fine arts.
Yeah.
So that was my direction. And then senior year, 11th, 12th grade, I had to change of course, and I sort of followed another major passion, which was environmental trees, and it worked out really well for me. But I still do a lot of art as well, and I do a lot of landscape designs and stuff over the many years, too.
Well, this is fantastic, and you use acrylics, eh?
This is all acrylics. I do a lot of things from pen and ink to pencil, but, yeah, this entire show is large-scale works, all acrylic paintings. A lot of the paintings are like 4 feet by 5 feet. They're some pretty big works.
Impressive. And the artist talk and reception is August 27th at 1 at the Guildhall Public Library. All right, now down to business. You ready?
Let's get down to business.
All right, the number is 800-348-2551. We go to Bob in beautiful Danbury, Connecticut. Bob, you're on.
Good afternoon. I have a question about foxgloves. I went to a friend's house, and he was growing them in early spring, and I kind of like fell in love with them. So on June 1st, I started seeding all around my house with foxglove seeds, and I must have about 100 plants now. But I know they won't flower this year, but how do I winter them over? And can I bring some inside and put them in a sunny window? Is it dangerous because I know they're poisonous?
First off, let me say I love foxgloves as well. They are one gorgeous, gorgeous plant. They are biennial, so you're correct in the sense that they are not going to flower from seed the very first year that you put them in. And you'll see like just kind of a rosette of foliage, which is what you have in your yard now. And, you don't really need to do much. You can pretty much just leave them alone. Make sure you know they do get water during those drought times, you know, just to break up drought periods like all the other plants. And this year has been, you know, the reoccurring theme has been water, water, water. We need to get plants water.
Right.
And this time of year is when plants, everything from trees, shrubs, and even perennials, they start to, and biennials like foxglove, they're going to start to store nutrients and water and everything it needs to leaf out next year and grow. So if they go into a real period of drought now, especially with trees and shrubs, they'll really start to suffer for the leaf out for next year. But other than that, you pretty much don't have to do much. Leave them alone, and they will come back for you next year. They are very hardy. And a lot of times by moving them around or try to bringing them in, you're actually going to be probably doing more harm than good, because they need to go through a really cold winter period for this to actually work out for you.
So, are they really poisonous?
Well, they are a poisonous plant. They're also used in, like, medicines. Like, if you've ever heard of, like, their Latin name is digitalis.
Oh, yeah? Oh, sure. So, heart medicine.
Heart medicines and stuff, I think, are derived from it. So it can definitely mess you up. Never eat the plant. It's considered poisonous. But a lot of times those poisons are often derivatives and sometimes used in the right doses in medicine.
So, well, Bob, thank you very much for that call. I didn't know that.
Great plan. A lot of times people say they're perennials, but they're not. They're biennials, but they will seed themselves back in and create more of this ongoing thing. But they're truly biennial.
Fred Breglia is our guest today, certified arborist and director of the Landis Arboretum. Kathy in Seward. Kathy, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Fred, I have... I'm in a pretty rural area, and I try to keep the forest hacked back, so to speak. And everywhere I try to plant something, I get plants in there that I don't want. The thing that's got me most concerned now is the poison parsnips.
Oh, yep.
They seem to be an invasive species, I think. I had never seen them around here before, and then, well, it's been a while, 25 years or more, and they've started to show up around here.
Okay, well...
Also, just wild berries and burdocks, they just keep coming, and I don't know how to deal with these guys.
Okay, well, first I want to make a quick sort of distinction between what a weed is and what an invasive plant is. And a weed doesn't mean it's invasive. In fact, the definition of a weed is any plant growing in a spot where you don't want it. So pretty much anything can be a weed by that definition. Now, an invasive plant is something that really takes over and prevents native plants from being able to function their sort of normal way. And it actually outcompetes the natives because they're more aggressive. And just because you have some of these plants there, doesn't mean that they're super hard to get rid of. But, knowing what plants you have and what you sort of what's going on is sort of the key. So you say you've been cutting back and sort of clearing more areas. Now, that means probably more sun in those areas, I got to assume. And as opposed to maybe the shadier environment that it currently or used to have. And if that's the case, then you're going to bring in some new, maybe unwanted guests. And poison parsnip, of course, really bad plant. If anyone out there doesn't know what poison parsnip is, please look it up online. The plant does cause some severe burns.
Really?
If you got that sap on you and it has a chance to get into sun, there's a phototoxic relationship there.
Darned.
So it creates some nasty burns, and I've had it over the years. And if you got that sap actually in your eyes, there's been cases where people have actually lost sight. Its bigger, more potent cousin is giant hogweed.
Okay, and we've heard of that one.
You've heard of that one. Poison parsnip is more common, and a lot of times more gets you more because you don't think it's bad. It looks like celery with yellow flowers.
Mm.
But in any case, any of these unwanted ones, at least the ones that you've mentioned so far, would be fairly easy to control with just frequent mowing. Now, of course, if you're cutting poison parsnip, you really want to make sure you have protective gear on. And, certainly take a shower right away. It does need to get into sunlight before it really activates. But constant mowing, if you can mow it low, it will not grow. Those plants will...
That's where I'm having the difficulty. I mean, my lawn, I mow, but these are like, sort of beds that I'm trying to keep around, with other plantings in them. And there I really...
So you have
a lot of problems. One other plant I wanted to mention, and it's a vine, and it grows up trees, and in the fall it turns an incredibly bright crimson scarlet color. It looks gorgeous, but I think it kills trees.
Well, the vine I got to assume you're talking about is Virginia creeper. It'll have like five little leaflets coming out of a single sort of, it's one leaf, but it's comprised of five leaflets. I like to say palmately compound leaves. But yes, beautiful, and it does not actually kill trees.
Okay, it does not.
No, I mean, if you got a lot of Virginia creeper up in the canopy of the tree, is it making the tree better? No. Is it competing? Yeah. Is it getting in with some of the leaves? Yes. But there are true killer vines, and Virginia creeper is actually related to Boston ivy, and Boston ivy is the one, if you ever go to like any of the universities, Yale and Harvard,
sure,
or any of those, it's all over the buildings, yep, the old buildings, mm-hmm, and we even have it at SUNY Cobleskill as well. Boston ivy is literally the same genus of plants as the Virginia creeper.
All right.
And so it's not a killer. There are things that kill, and you might say, well, if that's not a killer, how could a vine kill? Well, there are different ways of attachment, and that's the biggest factor.
It'll strangulate?
These guys attach with little ET suction cup fingers that kind of just hold on. And sometimes that could cause problems with bricks and stuff. But a true killer vine is something like Oriental Bittersweet, where it literally wraps itself around a tree,
yeah,
and it does exactly what you just said, Ray, strangulate. So if it's in a spot that you really don't want it, you can control Virginia creeper just by, you know, constantly cutting it back, and cutting it back at the right time of year, which is spring, when it leafs out, it uses all that stored energy. You cut it right then after it's used its stored energy, has very little energy to kind of re-leaf, and you can get rid of almost any nasty plant, especially any woody nasty plant that way, or even a good plant for that matter. But if it's not a killer, I say, hey, if you can live with it, it's an awesome fall color, and it's a great native, and I do like the Virginia creeper. So.
Fred Breglia is our guest. It's the Gardening Show today. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Arthur Zenkel Music Center at Skidmore College, a cultural resource for the upstate region, providing a teaching, recording, and performance venue with rental options available. Skidmore.edu/ZANKEL. Nine Pin Cider Works, hard cider made from locally sourced apples, tasting room Wednesday through Sunday at 929 Broadway, Albany. Be revolutionary, consider the apple, and drink New York apples. NinePinCider.com. The Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York, open Tuesday through Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 12 to 5. HydeCollection.org. ClipCentric Albany, a local video services division of ClipCentric, producing video advertisements for businesses throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV. Albany.ClipCentric.com. And Adams Ferriker Farms, Poughkeepsie, Kingston, Newburgh, and Wappinger. Trees, shrubs, blooming perennials, Adams-grown annuals and bedding plants, gardening supplies, and advice. AdamsFarms.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. It is our gardening show today, and Fred Breglia is our panel of one. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Fred is the director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. What's happening at the Landis Arboretum?
You know, we're really just gearing up right now for our fall plant sale. It's hard to believe, you know, we're saying the word fall right now,
oh,
but
yeah,
it's inevitable. Coming. And it's coming. But yeah, the fall plant sale is coming up this September 10th and 11th. 10 to 4 p.m. And it's free to come to the plant sale. We also have an incredible variety of used gardening books, and actually a used variety of all kinds of used books. I like to call it our Barn and Noble.
It's in
the barn. And we also have baked goods and stuff like that. Visit the website, www.landisarboretum.org, for all the details. But September 10th and 11th this year, 10 to 4.
Okay, very good. And the website once again, Fred?
LandisArboretum.org.
All right, before we get back to the phones and a lot of calls, let's take one from email. This is Robert from the town of Wright. Please address causes and solutions, if available, for tomato blight. And can water from a dehumidifier promote blight?
Well, you know, one of the things with tomatoes is they like uniform moisture. So sometimes they get, you know, sort of issues, and they stress out because of improper watering or not enough watering.
Yeah.
And this year, certainly no exception to that. We've been really, really dry. So it's kind of been hard to keep a constant water on those plants. I also urge people to water those plants always in the mornings to help prevent blight. Also, never get the leaves wet if you can help it. Always try to just water on the ground and a slower sort of drip situation, or even if you're just pouring a watering can, just try to keep the leaves dry. That's going to help those tomato plants as
well.
That's
counterintuitive to me, because in nature, when it rains, the water comes right down on the leaves.
Yeah, and that's correct. And then periods of wet seasons, you'll see tons of leaf blights everywhere.
Oh,
so it does work that way. But on a year that you have not a lot of water, supplemental waterings, but if you could control it, get it in just the root zone. Yes, not exactly what Mother Nature did, but this is actually, in a weird way, maybe a little bit better than Mother Nature, just for the specific tomato plant. Of course, we cannot perfect upon Mother Nature overall.
Now, what about the second part of that question regarding dehumidifiers?
You know, that's a good question, that one is. And, I don't think you're going to get tomato blight pathogens in dehumidifier water.
Interesting.
But you know what? That is coming out of moldy, musty basements. And, I personally think if I was eating the food, I'd probably just go with straight, clean water. Use that for any other plant that you're probably not going to eat. But do I think it's going to cause tomato leaf blight? No. But again, I'm putting it in my body.
Why risk it?
Water the other plants. Give it to some other trees.
All right.
So forth and so on.
Eric in New Windsor is next. Eric, you're on.
Hi. I have a privet hedge, which is probably 50 years old. And some of the sections were towering about 10 feet high. I've cleaned out some of the big stalks, but I left some big one is some 5 feet tall, somewhat, but it still sort of is very ugly and stalky, almost all wood. So how do I get that back to a nice privet hedge?
Yeah, and you certainly can. Privet lends itself to what we call sort of rejuvenation types of pruning, and with privet done at the right time, you could really bring that back. So when is the right time and how do you do it? All right. Well, basically, timing is going to be key. So springtime, when the buds sort of just begin to swell, they haven't actually opened up yet, you could do some pretty substantial cutting back of that privet hedge. In other words, if it's 5 feet, you could take it right back down to like 2 feet. And if it's like 10 feet or whatever you got, you could cut it back pretty dramatically. Get rid of any of the dead wood. I assume you probably got rid of most of that already. But dead wood any time of year. But the rejuvenation pruning to get that back to where you need it to be needs to be right in the spring. Early spring, the buds are beginning to swell. They haven't actually opened yet. No leaves have come out. You could almost theoretically cut that plant right to the ground, and then it's going to send up massive amounts of sprouts. And the reason why the timing is so important, because at that point in time, the roots are activated. Most of the stored energy that we talk about, these plants storing energy this time of year, storing food, storing water to leaf out next year, it's going to be all down in the root zone when you see that happening. When you see those buds just beginning to swell, it's the roots are sending up energy to those buds. So if you cut it right before it uses any of its stored energy, it's just going to put out tons of new growth. And you're going to have basically like a brand new privet hedge. But now you're going to have to be, take on the responsibility of shaping it and dealing with, retraining a new hedge. But you'd be getting a new sort of brand new clean slate, brand new chance at being able to keep this where you want it. And it's going to look a lot healthier.
Great. Thank you.
Got it.
Thanks a lot, Eric. We appreciate it. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Fred Breglia, our guest today on The Gardening Show, and Judy in Clifton Park. Judy, you're on.
Hi. I have a six-year-old Hikuro Nishiki, the Salix Integra tree on my front lawn.
Yep.
It's absolutely magnificent, except yesterday I noticed that there were a lot of dead leaves. Some of the leaves have just literally turned brown and were falling off. But on the same branch, way back near the tree, there's new growth. Can you tell me what's going on? Is it drought caused?
There's a few things that would do that. Drought is actually wreaking havoc this year in general, and I'm seeing environmental, what I call environmental problems, arise from that. And it is sometimes in the form of brown leaves. It also has been forming a really bad scorch around the leaf margins, or the edges of the leaves are getting really brown on a lot of plants. Maples of seeing it on and stuff. So drought is a factor, but there are a few other problems sometimes with any type of willow that that you might encounter. And without looking at this, it's hard to say over the phone, but I'll tell you some things that you can look for. One of them would be to see if there's if the leaves are actually just turning brown, or do they appear to be sort of eaten. And when I say eaten, I don't mean big chunks out of them. I'm almost thinking more like a skeletonized. In other words, they're eating the green pigment, because there is a leaf miner, a little leaf beetle, willow leaf beetle, that will wreak havoc. And if it's drought, the plant's stressed, and it will bring more plant problems like insects and diseases to your plant. They're stressed. They're going to find that stressed plant. So one thing to look for is whether or not those little leaves are actually any sort of feeding. And you can go online and look at willow leaf beetle and damage. And then you go Google Images, it's going to pull up tons of that stuff. So that's one other potential plant problem that you might have. And another thing it also sometimes gets are stem cankers. And if it's a stem canker, it's going to actually kill the entire branch. But the rest of the tree would be fine. It will almost never kill the trunk. So, certainly look for that. Now, what is a canker? I guess you would, from the scripture, I'd say sort of like a lesion on a human being. Think of a wound.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to look for that indentation. A canker is not like a gall. It doesn't come out. It actually goes in. And you'll see them on the smaller twigs. And that certainly, could explain that. If you're losing the twigs, you're going to lose the leaves. They're going to turn brown. They're going to fall off. And it might be all three of them. It might be, you might have the willow leaf beetle. You might have the stem canker. And it might be extra stress from drought. So kind of look at all of those factors. And if you do find some of those pests or critters, and you want more follow-up information, you could always shoot me an email to fred@landisarboretum.org.
All right, Judy, thanks a lot for the call. All right, help me out here with the logic. I see your point about things like the cankers finding the weaker trees, the ones that are stressed. But trees, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought trees would not have a natural physical defense against a beetle. How would a beetle... in other words, why would a beetle pick a stressed tree as opposed to a delicious, fresh, healthy tree?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's exactly, if you think of plant health care, and that's how I think of it, and that's how experts think of it, is if you think of plant health care very much on the same scale as human health care, things sort of make a little more sense. If you're a human being and you do have natural defenses, well, plants also do.
Against insects?
Well, they're going to have, if they're not undergoing stress, they're going to have way more sap flow. So, for example, this is just one example. You got an apple tree planted 2, 3, 4 years old. A round-headed apple borer could find, now it's an insect that flies, it lays little eggs, and these little larvae tunnel around and they eat vascular tissue. And that'll, one or two round-headed apple borer could kill a crab apple tree or an apple tree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a natural health, or a tree that has a lot of good health, a lot of vitality, has so much good sap flow that those little larvae start to tunnel, they'll actually drown in sap.
Oh my gosh, brilliant.
They don't ever even have a chance to feed. But a tree that is not healthy or stressed or undergoing drought or has other issues, it's going to be able to just work its magic, and it'll go through and it'll kill that plant very easily. So plant health and human health, there are definitely a lot of parallels.
Isn't nature wonderful? Neil in Ballston Lake. Neil, you're on.
Well, first time caller, and I have a problem with my tomatoes. Now, I don't understand why it takes so long for them to turn red. Now, of course, we've had a lot of cold weather during this growing season. The nights were cool, so I know that doesn't make them ripe. But is there something I can do to help my tomatoes turn red? And I know there's a commercial growers, when at the end of the season you have a lot of green tomatoes, isn't there a chemical they put on their tomato plants to make the tomatoes turn red?
Yeah, well, let me take the first part. The reason why most likely your tomatoes are not turning red is actually not to do with the cold. Ironically, it has to do with the heat. How many hot days have we had this summer? Quite a few hot days.
Yeah.
And more than normal. In fact, I got to think it's probably a record if that hasn't been announced yet. But either way, you have enough consecutive days over 85 degrees, and that's sort of the number, 85. You'll actually have tomatoes not ripen the way they normally would. And that's a big factor this year because we've had so many days in a row that have been over 85. So that's one reason why tomatoes sometimes actually don't ripen up, and it's sort of like almost works backwards. You would think cold would stop it, and of course, you get far enough into the fall, then cold is going to be the limiting factor. But when we're talking about August and they're not ripening, no, it actually has to do with the continuously warm days in a row, and it does prevent a lot of tomatoes from just naturally ripening. They're looking for that little bit of cold snap. They're breaking that temperature. Now, what can you do? Well, tomatoes don't produce the same sort of chemicals like bananas and apples. They naturally have a ripening chemical that often helps them ripen up. But what you can do, since the tomatoes really don't do it that way, is that you could take those, if you don't get them to ripen on their own on the vine, or you want to use some maybe in advance, you could pick some that kind of are looking like maybe they're turning, they're look maybe a little more yellow than green. Get those ones off, and you could put them in a bag with some apples, a brown bag, brown paper bag with some bananas. And those bananas and the apples will release the fruit ripening chemical in a very natural way. You'll be able to help sort of turn some of those green tomatoes or yellow tomatoes into a more red tomato that's palatable.
So do you think the tomatoes will eventually turn red this August?
If the cold doesn't get them, you know, at the end. But I think that you will start to, as the temperatures start to break, which they have, you know, you might very well start to see a lot of these start to go. So what I would do is try to, you know, have patience and give them time. And you should start to see in the next, you know, week or two some definite color changes. But if it goes far enough into the fall and you're not getting them red quick enough, you want to get them off, obviously, before they're lost to frost and things like that. So you could pull them all off.
One last question.
Yeah.
One last question. Some's eating the tomato. They eat half of the tomato, then they move on to the next one and eat another one. What do you think is eating those tomatoes?
You know, a lot of little critters will eat tomatoes. You know, it could be anything from a woodchuck to probably even, I don't know about squirrels or not, but you got a lot of critters. And you know, you got any other evidence?
I think, I've set a trap out for a live trap for a woodchuck, but I haven't seen them in a while. I think maybe the chipmunks are maybe eating them.
That's what I was going to say. Either woodchuck probably or chipmunk. They seem to get into most anything. You can also pick up a relatively cheap or inexpensive, like a trail cam that they sell sometimes for like hunters. They'll use them for seeing what, you know, comes to their stand when they're not around or off season and things like that. But, you know, it works really good to find out what the heck is eating my tomatoes. Put it out. You're going to catch them.
Oh, my gosh. So you're talking about evidence. It's like CSI Garden Edition.
You know, it's the new millennium, man.
That's
what can
incredible.
I say? But, you know, technology can be a good thing. Let's use it. And, you know, you'll find out exactly what it is, and then you're going to be able to, you know, proceed accordingly.
Fred Breglia is our guest today. 800-348-2551. Bob in Holyoke is next. Bob.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Last May this year, on a whim, I bought two cherry trees online. They were about 6 feet tall, bare root, and I had a arborist help me plant them.
Okay.
They've grown about a foot or more, but something is eating the leaves, and I can't see anything. I've gone out at various times of day, evening, and I can't see anything. I don't know, maybe it's a flying beetle or something, or what's attacking the leaves.
Can you give me
I wondered if you had any ideas. One is a Bing cherry and one's a black Tartarian cherry.
Okay.
I was told when I ordered them you needed to have two different varieties to cross-pollinate.
Yep. Well, can you give me a little bit of a description as to what the damage, when you say eating the leaves, what does that look like? Is it big chunks?
Or eating along the edges of the leaves.
Okay, so they're taking like more bigger chunks.
Yeah.
And they're leaving mostly green leaves there with like missing pieces.
Right.
How much of that tree do you think is getting eaten?
All the new leaves that have come out. Since it was bare stock when we got it.
Okay.
It was about 6 feet tall when we got it out of the box.
Okay.
But, you know, it's leafed out. Both of them have leafed out.
Yep.
And ever since it started leafing out, something's been eating at the edges of all the leaves.
Okay. When you say those big pieces, that typically is like some kind of worm or caterpillar. So
okay.
I don't know if you've looked around at the tree and sort of look for worms. Or sometimes they could be really small, and oftentimes they could, you know, be the color of leaves. They're often that way for camouflage, so birds can't get them. So I would urge you first to look very closely. Things that are edible, like cherries, they're not just good for people. They're good for a lot of the other critters as well. So a lot of those edible plants are often victims of other unwanted attacks or, you know, predation in that sense. So, but it does sound like it's a type of a caterpillar or worm. My guess is that it's never going to actually kill your tree. Now, there's two sort of thresholds to treat pests at. There's an aesthetic threshold, and there's an economic threshold.
Right.
The economic threshold is at what point do you actually suffer a loss? In other words, the tree's health is now going down. So I tend to do manage pests, I tend to work more on an economic threshold. If it's going to kill my tree, I've got to do something for it. And an aesthetic threshold is, well, that's up to the person. But it literally is not to the point where it's going to actually create damage to the actual tree. Just, you know, a lot of things can eat the leaves all year and the tree's going to be fine. So first off, you have to ask yourself, you know, and this one definitely I would say is not an economic threshold thing. It's an aesthetic threshold thing. So can you tolerate it? If it does get to the point where they're eating like a quarter of the foliage, then that's going to probably start to break into that economic threshold. It's going to stress the plant out, in which case you want to treat it. So, you know, first, can you live with it? The other thing is the time of year that it's happening. Has this been going on all season?
Yes.
All right. So yeah, I would certainly look for that. And if they're little critters, you might be able to hand-pick them off, get rid of them.
Yeah.
But a lot of times there's products called like BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a bacteria, beneficial, and you could spray these on. It'll eat up a lot of crawlers. For example, like the spring tent caterpillar that you very well could get on your tree. Easily controlled, no nasty chemicals, a bacteria, spray it on. You follow
what's
the instructions. Bacillus thuringiensis, BT. You can ask for BT.
Okay.
And they'll give it to you. And it's the same thing for the fall webworm. You'll see those like and the cherries are trees that really are magnets for both spring tent caterpillar and fall webworm. And the BT will actually take out both of those critters. So but it's always good to ID the critter before we go after it. So, you know, do inspect that tree. Look at the leaves. Look under the leaves. Look for something that could be really, really small, smaller than you think. About 95% of all the insects are either neutral or beneficial to plants. There's only about 5 or even I think it's less than that. It might even be like 2% of all the insects that are actually bad. Most of them are really tiny.
It's Vox Pop. Fred Breglia is here. It is The Gardening Show. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Time for a break and then we'll hit the home stretch.
Support comes from the New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, celebrating 35 years serving the public. 800-342-3661. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, maintaining 32 miles of trails throughout the Lake George region for hiking, birding, and outdoor exploration. HikeLakeGeorge.com. Maybe Farm Historic Site, Rotterdam Junction, presenting the annual Arts and Crafts Festival, regional handmade arts and crafts, including jewelry, clothing, pottery, baskets, soaps, and more. This Saturday, 10 to 3, SchenectadyHistorical.org. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. And the University at Albany Theater Program, working to train the next generation of performers, designers, technicians, playwrights, and stage managers. albany.edu/theater.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here and Fred Breglia right across the table. It's our gardening show for the month of August. Before we get back to the phones, Fred, this one came in from Trey in Hartwick, New York, out Cooperstown way. Trey wants to know, is now a good time to apply triple phosphate to my apple orchard to improve blooming for next year? I have 19 trees ranging in age from 1 to 10 years old, and that is from Trey in Hartwick.
Yep, so it sounds like he wants to give, because basically what he's saying is there's a lot of trees and plants want a lot of phosphorus when they bloom. The best time to get that is either when you apply fertilizers in general, two best times. One is the spring, prior to bud break, so very early on in the spring. They always say roots before shoots. In other words, roots are gathering material before shoots start to come out. You want to put that down in the springtime. It works really, really well. The roots absorb material rapidly. So that's probably the overall best time of the year. The next best time, second best time, or actually some people will say the best time, is fall. But not right now. It's going to be actually late fall when about, I'd say, 2/3 of all the leaves are on the ground. In other words, these guys are going to sleep. Half the leaves are down here in mid-October at least. And that's another really good time to apply fertilizer. And sometimes I actually, with some things I really want to push growth on, and apples are one of them, I'll do a spring fertilizer and I'll do a fall application as well. So spring prior to bud break, fall after about half the leaves are dropped.
All right. Fred, now we go to Fred, another Fred in Cooperstown. Fred, you're on with Fred.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How's it going, Fred?
I'm calling about bindweed.
Yep.
Bindweed.
And, yes, we had some that was introduced into our flower garden, and we made the mistake when we were taking it out of that of throwing it down into our meadow, and now it's encroaching upon our garden.
Yep. Bindweed is a nasty one, and you know, it does produce a nice little flower that looks kind of like a morning glory. So some people actually like it, and in some cases, it's actually been cultivated for a short amount of time until they realize it takes over their entire garden. So yes,
right.
But no, it's a really difficult one to deal with. It does pull out quite easily, so if you can get the root out of it in a small scale setting, like in a perennial garden or something, or vegetable garden, it's not bad. But when it gets into a meadow, the best way to deal with it is probably through mowing if you can. It won't tolerate frequent low mowing. So any area that you can frequently low mow, bindweed goes away, guaranteed. And then all the other areas where it is, you're going to try to go for the root. Be a ruthless gardener. Leave no prisoners. Take them all.
Very good. Now, how about mites? Have you ever heard of using mites to attack it?
You know, there are a lot of different beneficials. I've never used mites to get rid of bindweed. I've always, pretty easily got rid of it through either, mowing, like I said, low, constantly keeping it that way. And you don't have to do it a short amount of time. And then it does seem to come out pretty easily in the gardens because it puts an obnoxious amount of foliage out of a little single point from which it grows from the ground. And just go for the roots. So I would recommend those two ways to go for it.
Now, that's interesting. We have in our backyard, there were millions of them when we first moved in 15 years ago. They're not bamboo. They're Japanese something.
Oh, the Japanese knotweed. Okay. Yeah, that one's a tough one, too. Boy.
So, but I was always told don't pull them by the roots. Cut them at the base often because I heard that they will propagate if you pull them up.
They can. Not everything is. Bishop's weed's another really good example of one that, you know, you try to pull it and you pull it for years, and gardeners, you know, we go crazy just pulling this weed over and over and over, and it just keeps coming because any little piece of that root system that's left in the ground is a brand new little plant.
So you just cut it.
So with Japanese knotweed, you can get rid of it just constantly mowing it. But remember, just like all these plants, they leaf out with stored energy in the spring. So the best time to get them is right after they use up all that stored energy and then be the ruthless gardener, go in and mow, mow, mow.
So fall's not a good time to attack them.
Any time is good to just start. If you're going to mow, start mowing, sure, because then it's going to have less energy. But if you get it in the spring, it's going to have more of an effect.
The problem, of course,
everything's
is
a
these
little
are
different.
All through our pachycendra and on hills and in gardens, you have to snip them. We can't use a mower. So it's a long process.
Yep. And I mean, the last, drastic measure is always, you could use a herbicide of some sort to get rid of it, but I don't ever like to really, I'm the same way. I'd rather, get it out a natural way. And there's so many good natural ways. But when I say herbicide, I mean an environmentally friendly.
Right.
There's vinegars that'll burn them right up.
Yeah. But there's other things as well that are around them. That's the problem, right?
Yeah. But they're a contact herbicide. So you can use a paintbrush with a distilled, super highly concentrated vinegar. Dip the paintbrush in. It's going to burn up foliage. But it is a foliar burner. It, point to note is that it's not going to get sucked
right
up into the root.
Right.
It will still come up. So you got to reapply.
I think I think my easiest option is to have my wife go out and snip them at the base.
No comment on that
okay.
one.
Okay. We're back to the phones. Andrew in Saugerties. Andrew, you're on.
Hi there. Good afternoon. In my yard, I have a grove of azalea and rhododendron plants. I have them planted in pine straw mulch, and they're underneath a pine tree in sandy soil.
Okay.
So occasionally every year I add, I add to it in the spring. And this year I planted a white azalea towards the front of it.
Okay.
And it's in an area that gets some, this time of year, gets late afternoon sun. All summer long it's shaded by the pine trees, but as the sun is lower, it gets afternoon sun. So I put up sunscreens and like shades in front of it to block the sun, the heavy, intense sun. And the plant was doing really well all year. I mean, really, really well. Cared for it, a little more intensely than the others because it wasn't established. But then about earlier this week, right around the weekend, I noticed it started wilting. And, I've been giving it more intense water since then. I kind of, with my hand, lightly brushed off any of the leaves that would come off. But I'm not sure what other steps to take, and I'm not sure if it's a water-deprived situation or or am I overwatering? I just don't know.
Yeah, well, there are some pests that could create some damage to the vascular tissue and create a wilt-like symptom. So that is possible, but
my other plants in there are doing great, though. Every one of them is flourishing all around it. So.
Yeah. Okay. So then, and the fact that you just installed this plant this year means it's more a little more intense care than the rest of them. But it sounds like it's almost guaranteed probably a drought-related symptom. Now, wilting comes from kind of a couple of different reasons if it comes to environmental. Too little water, this is the no-brainer. It clearly will create a wilt symptom. Too much water will also create a wilt symptom. A drowning plant will wilt. It's the exact same function. Neither way, there's no water being able to be brought in to that plant. It's literally suffocating. So, but my guess is probably inadequate watering, especially the fact that it's under pines. If you get any natural rain, it's going to, you know, have a harder time getting into that root system of that plant. And then on top of that, you had mentioned the sandy soil. Sandy soils tend to be a little bit more dry. They drain water out more rapidly. Adding a little bit of organics to those sandy soils when you install trees like or plants like this is going to help you. But
yeah, I put down holly tone with it would that be something good to add now, some holly tone?
No, actually, holly tone is not a soil amendment. Holly tone is a fertilizer, and general rule is the first year you install any tree or shrub, you actually don't want to fertilize the very first year. You could add a little bit of I always recommend adding mycorrhizae, which is a beneficial fungus, and we don't have enough airtime for me to really go into the details on mycorrhizae. But if you Google mycorrhizae spelled mycorrhizae, I promise you, you'll be a fan of the product. But anyways, back to the question, probably just inadequate watering, not enough watering. You want to try to do thorough watering, especially with sandy soil. And you want to do it about once a week to break up drought times on any newly installed tree. Honestly, with drought like the way we've had it this year in dry conditions and heat, probably even two-year plantings would be beneficial with supplemental watering. So think of less frequent, more thorough waterings. And people ask me, how long do I got to water? Well, the question is, time it. Go out to your yard. You're the person with the soil. Every single site's a little bit different. Run the hose or the sprinkler system a half an hour. Dig a hole. You want to get about 12 inches or more of the soil profile wet.
Okay.
Time it, and mulching too. Not on the stems, away from stems, but mulching will help conserve water, especially on sandy soils. But any soil, mulching is a good thing.
But do remember to check for any water restrictions in your area. I know there are several communities around here dealing with water restrictions.
Okay. Good point. Good point. Right.
Let's go to Dorothy in Great Barrington. Dorothy, you're on.
Oh, hello. I have two very old apple trees in my backyard. They were trimmed in early March.
Okay.
And one of them, I've lost about two-thirds of the leaves. I thought fall was coming early. But number one, I was wondering if it was the trimming that has caused it. And number two, if all the leaves even fall off, is the tree dead or will it come back next year?
Okay. Well, let's take the first part of that question, which is, was it caused by trimming? And the answer to that is no. No, you pruned it at the right time of year, it sounds like, early spring. And no, absolutely no way that it would be making leaves drop throughout the season. So that part we're taking care of. Now, what's causing it? Most likely, it is apple scab disease. And if you look at the leaves, my guess is on those leaves that are fallen and even the ones that are probably still on the tree, you're going to see a little dark spot here or there. Doesn't need to be a lot. Could be one, could be two. Think of a scab on a person. It's called apple scab for a reason. It looks like a little tiny scab. And sometimes it's not big. It's quite small and kind of hard to detect, but you're looking for a dark sort of stain or spot on that leaf. And very, very common to defoliate. It's probably one of the most common defoliators. The other thing that is a disease that's really, really common, also causes defoliation throughout the year, especially at the end of summer, is the cedar apple rust. Cedar apple rust means it needs a cedar tree, which is technically a juniper, and a apple to complete the life cycle of that particular pathogen or that particular disease. But what it's going to look like on an apple is little orange spots. And if you were to look at the bottom of that little orange spot late in the season, you'll see little fungal little tentacles coming out of that little orange spot. But this time of year, you might not see many of those. But if you see orange, you see black, dark, or both, you very well probably almost guarantee that's the problem. Now, what do you do for that? There are certain kinds of different horticultural sprays, like when I say spray, I mean good friendly products like horticultural oils work really, really well to control them. But they are preventatives. They are not cures. So in other words, this would have to be applied early in the growing season, right when the leaves first start coming out, or even before that. You'd have to check with the labeling of the product to find out the exact timing. But it would not be something that you could spray on now to fix the problem that you currently have. But but the good news is that this is not going to kill your tree.
Oh, good.
If it is apple scab or rust, because it's going to create a real defoliation end of summer, kind of when leaves are starting to drop off anyways. If it does take all the leaves, that's not necessary, you know, especially in August, that's not the best thing. And one environmentally friendly way to control some of that, if it is that, again, look for the leaves to make sure you see the spots. But you could rake up all of that material, all those fallen leaves. Don't compost them. Get them off site. All those fallen leaves actually have next year's pathogens right there, the fungal spores for the infection. You could also check to see if there's any mechanical damage on the tree. In other words, something that was eating the bark or the trunk real low kind of things. Those are reasons why you would see that too. But it's almost guaranteed probably apple scab or cedar end or cedar apple rust. Look for the spots, clean up the leaves, maybe some horticultural oil next year for the growing season, and keep pruning at the time you did, and I think we're in good shape.
Dorothy, thank you so much for the call. Fred Breglia is our guest. Amy in Albany is next. Amy.
Hi, I have a question about possibly transplanting some shrubs.
Okay.
I've got a bridal veil spirea and a zebra grass that were planted much too close together. They're both like 4.5 or 5 feet tall. And if possible, I'd like to move one. And I was wondering if one of them would be easier to move or if one of them would be more likely to survive a move. If so, which one and when I should do it?
You know, first off, you could certainly move those plants. Yes, not a problem. They both actually transplant fairly well. I've all the years I've been doing horticulture, probably almost 27 years now, I've never lost a spirea bridal wreath ever from transplanting. They have shallow root systems. The root systems stay together really, really well. And turf is also super tough. So any kind of grass is also, you know, easy to move. So I think really you take your pick. Like I said, either one's going to probably transplant quite well. But I would wait till fall. Wait till it gets to be a little bit cooler and a little bit more adequate moisture. It's just so dry this time of year. If you did move it this time of year and you were able to give it supplemental watering, you'd probably be okay. But I think if you wait till the dormant season, leaves are falling off, you could, you know, move it quite easily then. Also, spring would be another easy time. It's kind of like the sleeping baby. Pick him up when he's sleeping, move him to a different room. He wakes up, he doesn't even know he's moved. Same principle to plants. Move them when they're sleeping. When they wake up, they don't know they were moved, and they don't yell at you about it.
There you go.
Oh, great. So end of October probably would be good.
Yeah, if you were going to do a fall move. You could actually go around them preventative or in prep for this, but with a spade, just kind of make what we call a root prune. So you're going to trace the root ball. Don't try to dig it. Just stick it straight down into the soil, cutting roots, leave it right in the soil. Make sure you water it well before you do that. And as Ray said, if you're in a spot with water restrictions, check that requirement too. But yeah, you should be in good shape. So root prune it now, move it in the fall.
All right, Amy, thanks a lot. This one came in via email from Anne, who says, I planted a Magnolia Anne this spring. It flowered a little, had a few leaves, but overall didn't do much. What can I do now to help it to next spring and beyond? It's a new tree, so I've been good rewatering it. And that is from Anne.
All right. Well, she said she's watered it, so that's a good thing. Right now, this time of year, anybody with trees, shrubs, we can really, if you don't have any water restrictions, get some water down. Less frequent, more thorough, less frequent waterings are always the best.
Okay.
You could also put a surface mulch on there to help it for the winter. Make sure you're not mulching on the stems.
That's it?
Fertilizer in the fall.
That was the quickest answer I've ever heard you give.
Well, we could continue this, but I'm trying to get through the rest of these questions. But in
any
case,
I don't think we're going to get to any more calls.
All right, then I'll elaborate a little bit more. Put down some fall fertilizer, or I should say some spring fertilizer, not this fall, but actually in the spring prior to bud break. One thing you could do if it's a really small plant, too, is you could build a little burlap sort of shelter around it for that first year. Magnolias are hardy, but sometimes the flower buds get blighted out from So, you know, something that you could do there. And another great thing to do is make sure that the tree is installed right to the perfect depth. And how do you know that? I would say there's a great diagram, free website put out by the International Society of Arboriculture on a site called treesaregood.com. You can also go to the landisarboretum.org website. We have a link to Trees Are Good, and they'll show you diagrams of proper plant installation. It's very important to get the plant at the perfect depth. Too deep and the plant will never do good. A little bit higher, and I've never seen a plant die from being planted too high.
Fred Breglia, brilliant job today. Now, when is the big sale?
The plant sale is going to be September 10th and 11th this year, 10 to 4. Visit the website. Landis Arboretum. It's free to come on out, and we're going to be giving free tours. We have a lot of sculpture there. You name it. Come visit us.
Fred, thanks a lot. Support comes from Rhinebeck Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials, Rhinebeck, New Paltz, and now at 793 Broadway in Kingston, rhinebeckart.com. Agricultural Stewardship Association presenting their 15th annual Landscapes for Land's Sake art exhibit October 8th through 10th in Washington County. Opening reception October 8th, noon to 5 p.m. to benefit local farmland protection, agstewardship.org. The Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies and performance, newpaltz.edu/theatre. And Poughkeepsie Farm Project, connecting food, farm, and community, organically grown CSA shares, available for the fall 2016 season, farmproject.org. Thanks again to Fred Breglia for being here. Thanks to our engineer, not written down, but I remember, it's not Jordan Marsh, it's Jordan Taylor. That's right. And Deb Malik answered the phones. Our producer, Jessica Marshall, I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's a Food Friday. Stand by for news.